Hello and welcome to Film Kid Asks, the podcast where I ask questions to working professionals in the film industry from the perspective of someone just getting started. My name is Jordan, and today I'm joined by Lachlan Milne, the extremely talented cinematographer who has worked on projects like Minari, Love and Monsters, Stranger Things, and Hunt for the Wilder People, just to name a few of his impressive credits. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Lachlan.
Pleasure, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Killer intro, by the way. Thank you. So I always ask people, especially if they're from kind of smaller film markets, how do you think the landscape you grew up in as an Australian affects your approach to visual storytelling?
That's a good question. I was born into the film industry, so I kind of absorbed it via osmosis, if that makes sense. My dad was a director and my mum used to be a flatbed Steenbeck editor and then became a drama teacher. So I kind of sort of grew up on sets from a really early age in Adelaide, which is the capital city of a small place called South Australia, which is the bottom in the middle of Australia when you look at a map. But as far as the landscape goes, I mean, I used to go away on jobs a lot with my parents, especially like little domestic jobs. So we'd go out to the desert in the middle of the country. And obviously when you go out there, you want to try and shoot the best times of day. So you'd always be up early and out late, you know? So I guess that kind of introduced me to, because so much of the light here, particularly in Australia, is so harsh for so much of the year. And you get really small windows of it being beautiful. And obviously as a filmmaker, you try and maximize that as possible. But I guess, particularly when I first started working, the big difference, especially coming from our part of the world to say something and eventually working in America or Europe, is that our level of independent filmmaking comes from a very modest budget background. So you have to be quite intuitive and think laterally as far as problem solving or what sort of stuff goes when you first start. So it's easier, I should say, anyway, when you have nothing and then all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where you have everything, rather than going the other way around. So I've always thought that that was quite fortuitous and advantageous for me on a professional level to start small, because when you have to be adaptable and sort of think on your feet, it makes everything else easier when you can throw money at a problem and make it go away. It's much harder when you can't.
Yeah, no, that entirely makes sense. It definitely seems like that's the better way to have it, chips fall. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what to you, I guess, is the most creative part of the process of filmmaking, especially in your role? Would it be like the pre-production and, you know, figuring that out? Is it on set? Is it in post when you're doing the color grade? What is the most creatively fulfilling part?
There's aspects of all three of those things that I really like. But I think initially the thing that I really love is just bashing out the approach that stylistically that you want to have with a director in pre-production. That's what I love. It's essentially just like, ideally what I try and do is get as much time with them one-on-one as possible beforehand. And obviously the closer you get to shooting, the more it ramps up for them as far as, you know, wardrobe and makeup and rehearsals and all that sort of stuff. So if you try and do that early on, I always like to ask the director, what kind of film do you want to make? You know, like totally what kind of project is it? Because rather than just going in all guns blazing saying, this should all be handheld or this should be locked off or we should shoot it in black and white or it should be on film or whatever. Like I always like to read the script initially as an audience member and then have an open dialogue with the director about creatively what is the most important way that we should think about executing this project rather than having a preconceived notion of it should be this and it can only be this way. Because I think it has to be a bilateral conversation and they're focusing on separate things, different thematic concerns or what's the subtext of the movie, all that sort of stuff. So I really like bashing that out in the beginning because there's often stuff that isn't in the script that they want to highlight. You know, this is a film about love or it's about revenge or it's about family or whatever. So thinking about that can influence how you photograph a picture as well. You know, if it's a family picture, maybe you want to be a little wider and you want to fit more people into the frame and not do so much closer coverage, you know, little stuff like that I always find really interesting. And shooting, if you go in there with a plan, shooting is essentially problem solving almost all day, all the time, you know, because stuff happens, especially in low budget filmmaking, that nobody anticipates, but you have to, you know, you've got two options. You can throw your toys out of the pram or you adapt or die, you know. And I think that that's one of the great thrills is, and one of the great important things, I guess, about getting a like-minded team around you is that you have to rely on people like that in a pinch. So I love the problem-solving component of it and being creative, especially in lower budget things where you have to be smart about how you want to execute things. And color grading as well, it's like the final piece of the puzzle, because particularly as a cinematographer, there are plenty of times where I think it's important where if you know you can compromise on the day in order to get a better performance or to be faster or something like that, knowing that you can fix something at the other end and without anybody ever knowing about it, I think that that's an important skill to have, because you could spend, you know, that extra 20 minutes you might be spending to take a bit of light off the wall in the background that, you know, once you get into timing, you could drop a window on and it'll take 5 minutes and you'll gain that extra 20 minutes on set. The cast can do another two or three takes or something, which might end up with a better result. I think that that's something that's worth thinking about, and the knowledge of all three of those components and how they all make you, you know, more efficient and smarter at your job, I think are really important.
Yeah, you mentioned the relationship and speaking early with the director about, you know, the tone and getting the kind of story pieces to start to fit together. What does the relationship look like with the production designer in those early stages of prep?
Sure. A lot of the times the production designer gets on earlier than the DP does. So in Minari, my very first day of pre-production, Yong, the production designer, had already been on there for 2 days. And the first thing I had to do was sign off on the trailer literally the first morning of pre-production. So they'd already had to. So just give a little head start, and sometimes you come in a little late to the party. And that was one of those things where it was obviously, you know, it's in 65 or 70% of the movie, and it was the same exterior as interior trailer. So, and we couldn't pull any walls or anything. So, you know, it was a decision that we had to get right, which I think ultimately we did. But that is just like a small little microscopic version of sometimes you can end up with an accelerated pre-production as a relationship with the production designer. But because I lean so heavily on art department with practical lighting and colors of walls, and, you know, the only thing like we did on that trailer was I asked where the table is. There was no window, and so much of the dialogue happened around there. So I said, why don't we just cut a hole and turn that into a window, so that for all the days, you know, it would be easier for us to quickly tell a difference between day and night, always have a nice way to light through. So that's the only thing we really did from a design side of things. I always like to know where the light's coming from when I work, if that makes sense. So if I see a practical in the back corner, that will be the motivating source. And so I talk to set deck and production design a lot about that sort of stuff. And I'm always interested to see what their palette of the film is. You know, sometimes people come in and they say this scene should feel green, or this scene should feel warm, or whatever it is, because that can obviously be enhanced with the lighting that we choose to do on the day. So yeah, that's kind of like the holy trinity. It's like the production designer, director, and cinematographers. And if once that's humming, then yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I was actually curious about how, if the trailer was a separate, you know, exterior and interior, because it feels quite large on the inside. So it felt like it might be a set. I feel like it was probably also the kind of wider lenses and stuff, but it made it feel like, I don't know, I wasn't sure. But you guys did a great job with that.
It's true. That was a real challenge. It was really tough because, yeah, you know, 9 times out of 10, you put the camera in a doorway, and that was a place that had one access point, and we had to put another one out the back just so we physically could get cast in and out and equipment, et cetera, and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, no, we favored it. I always wanted it to be a much wider film. I wanted it to be a photographic and ensemble piece because, like you said before, the cast is so strong. And I wanted to fit as many people into the frame at one time as possible and keep it more like a live event rather than getting editorial with, you know, shot, reverse shot, and breaking coverage up. I like it, particularly when you can have actors who will step on each other's lines, because you're not worried about that overlap with sound, because you're going to cut in and, you know, sound, of course, always want clean coverage. But if you hold everybody in the same frame, then it can be a bit messier. And for me, it always feels a bit more observed and more real, which I really like.
Yeah, it kind of gives it, like you said, the feeling of a photograph or almost a memory, which is really, really cool and really well done. Jumping back to prep, I am curious, what is the difference in your approach to prep when it comes to working on a project that you get to kind of author the vision of, like Minari or Love and Monsters, versus coming onto a project later like Stranger Things? How does your approach differ, or is there a difference in how you approach
it? For sure. There really is. Yeah, I'll use Stranger Things as an example. So I did season 3 and season 4 this year and last year, but because of COVID. It was unusual. I'd never done television before, and B, I'd never done anything where, to your point, I'd never had that initial conversation with the director and the production designer about the look of the project. And I did inherit a lot of stuff about that. I remember one of the first conversations I had with the Duffers about what my role on that show was going to be, was how true do we want to stay to a lot of the stuff, or how much creative license do we have, etc. And they were really good about it, in the sense that they were like, well, we love Hawkins to look like Hawkins, so, you know, we would like that in a particular way. It's like when you go into like the Wheeler basement, for example, and all the kids are sitting around playing Dungeons and Dragons, there was always one way that we would like that, just so it felt familiar, if that made sense. But then, you'd have something like The Mall, which hadn't necessarily been established in previous seasons, and then The Fairground, which I shot all of, which were new sets. And so once we did those, then it was kind of, you know, I had a little bit more carte blanche in a sense to be able to really establish what that looked like. And so I worked really tightly with Chris Trujillo and Sean Brennan, the art director, and Jess Royal, the set deck, about practicals and colours. And we did heaps of testing because I wanted, when we had to do the final monster scene in season three in The Mall, I really wanted it to be in camera as much as possible, with the obvious exception being the monster. That wasn't a real monster. That was VFX.
Really?
Yeah. Just to clarify. And so I wanted to do as much neon work there as possible. And so we ended up, this is one of the luxuries. This is like where you come from Hunt for the Water People, which is like a $3.5 million indie. And then you do something as massive as Stranger Things. It's like we were able to physically rewire the entire mall and put the entire mall through a lighting desk and get, you know, $250,000 worth of custom made neon and wire all that through the desk and put starters in them that were strong enough to be able to flicker them on and off without the gases inside burning out. So, you know, so that gives you a bit of an idea of when you have and when you don't have and what you can do. It was great to be able to do that because I think if we had to solely rely on VFX to create the ambience of that room, I think it would be a very different scene. And again, I'm a huge fan of things feeling as integrated as possible and as real as possible from a lighting side of things as we can get it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love all of the mall. I think that was such a great look, the bathroom stuff. And then, yeah, of course, the neon at the end was, and, you know, the ice cream shop. I really
like something like 35 period appropriate redesigned shops in that mall. Like you could walk into any of those shops and shoot it. And the pictures on the wall would be period, but the records in Sam Goody's would, you know, like it was just phenomenal. Like the level of detail, there would be period money in the cash registers. It's unbelievable.
That's insane. On a previous episode, we interviewed someone from Mad Men, and it was the thing, apparently. Yeah, everything was very meticulously designed so that it was all period, and there were, and everything functioned, you know? You could open anything, drawers, and
that's a beautiful show, isn't
so
it?
So I think that's really interesting. Yes. So you've worked obviously with some pretty phenomenal people, some different crews, directors, producers that are pretty, you know, well known. What makes for a great set environment?
I think you have to have a balance between levity and seriousness. I don't think it could be, it can be 100% either way. I think that you have to know when to have a laugh and when to knuckle down and get stuck in. And I think that it has to be a good balance between the two. And I think that comes from the top, because you set the tone as a head of department, and people look at the directors and the DPs and obviously first ADs, et cetera, people that are there at the front all the time. That combined with the fact that people need to feel like they can contribute and that there's not going to be consequences for putting forward an idea that people might not like or might not be appropriate. You know, it's like a good idea is a good idea, whether it's me or set deck or the catering department. You know, if it makes the project better, then that's in everybody's best interests. I think as a leader, as a head of department, you have to, first of all, get really good people, ideally people that are better than you, and enable them to do their jobs. I think that those are the most important things.
Yeah. I mean, again, that makes complete sense.
Sounds simple enough, but it's I when I was an assistant, I used to work on sets that weren't like that, that were more like the DP would think that they had to completely call the shots, and they'd speak to a gaffer and say, I want this kind of light on this kind of stand, and I want to put it exactly there. And then all of a sudden you're turning a gaffer that's an incredibly creative position into a technical lamp operator, you know, and then you can see them being deflated because they have more to offer in that role, but they're being muzzled in a way that, I don't think it's right to have that kind of environment. I think everybody needs to be able to think freely and act freely and contribute.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a big thing is just kind of removing the ego. And letting 100%. People voice thoughts.
And put your hand up if you don't know something. There's no shame in not knowing something, you know. Just, every single job I do, you learn something. And from people that you wouldn't necessarily expect to. But that's one of the great things about filmmaking. You know, technology is changing all the time. The advancements in LED lighting, cameras are essentially computers with lenses on them now. And 6 months later, there's another one that comes out that does, you know, goes to 11. So, you know, like there's a lot of different changes all the time. So don't fear knowledge.
Yeah. So having worked on Stranger Things, Minari, Hunt for the Wilder People, and Little Monsters, which all involve children's or teens on set, is there anything that you need to be mindful of? And yeah, what expertise can you share from those experiences?
I don't quite know how that happened, but you're right. It's not like something I actively sought out, but somehow I have done a lot of work with kids now. And I do love it. It's really fun. But to your point, there is a lot of stuff that you can do from a photographic side of things to get the best out of kids. The biggest mistake you can make is putting limitations on them. And that can be from a lighting side of things. You know, like you can't tell a six-year-old to walk from there to here and hit this mark and then deliver a perfect performance and then turn this way while we cut to this camera and then walk out of frame, because it just doesn't work like that. So you have to be flexible. You have to, you know, use a broader brush, particularly from a lighting side of things, and you have to be adaptable. I mean, I think a lot of times when I shoot kids, I always operate, with the exception of Stranger Things, because it's too big and most of the time I'm planning things. But everything else I've done, I've always operated a camera. And part of the reason I do that is so that I can react to what's happening. Particularly with kids, I tend to shoot a lot of handheld stuff, not necessarily to make it look handheld, but just so that I can move when they move, because again, it's about not trying to limit them as much as you can. Another trick is, and this is one I learned this early on, like if you limit the amount of filtration you have in a camera, particularly when you're shooting with kids, I mean, what happens when you put a glass filter like an ND or a diffusion or something like that in there is it essentially becomes a mirror. So it can be really distracting. So if you're doing a close-up of a kid and you're three or four feet away, and then you have the camera at a particular angle, all of a sudden they'll catch half of their reflection and then they've looked at the lens and then that takes gone. You know, and then you have to start again. So I tend to use cameras that have internal NDs, or I use older lenses that have more of an aesthetic that I'm not trying to manipulate with filtration, to kind of get around that. So that's a really good little tip when with working with kids. But be patient. It's very easy with kids for too much information to come from too many different people if stuff isn't happening. So particularly as a camera operator, I say that to anybody, is don't feel like you have to comment on what they're doing all the time, because there should really only be one person doing that, and it should be the director. And it's very tempting, unless you have a particular relationship with the director and they come up to you and say, I need you to help him or her through this thing. And that happens to me sometimes, and then you take over and it's fine. But as long as it's understood from everybody, just don't overwhelm them with too much information, because they're just kids.
Yeah, I honestly never would have thought of the ND thing, but that is such a good tip, because I could totally see that being distracting and not something that they're necessarily kind of prepared for yet.
All good tips. Kids, they're not professional actors who are used to ignoring that sort of stuff.
Exactly. So you've worked on quite a few smaller budget and independent projects. What are some of the challenges for the camera department, and how do you navigate those on a tighter budget? Because obviously we've talked about the sandbox mode version, which is Stranger Things, and getting to do that. But what are some things that you can do to make it look good and navigate those challenges on a lower budget feature or project?
You know what the biggest thing is if it's an exterior day, the biggest tool in your arsenal is scheduling. I know that sounds weird, but the biggest thing you can do is break down the schedule with the first AD and try and favor it towards times of day and locations that you think will be more favorable. And obviously, you know, the page one is always trying to get things as backlit as possible, because it's faster to work. It looks better. You don't have to control it quite so much. You know, you don't have shadows of yourselves or equipment, et cetera, going over actors. So that's obviously something that we always look for. But I always try and keep it simple. And one of the temptations with some people I know is to have a variety of different lookup tables when you're shooting on digital these days for each scene or each setup. And I always tend to have two, maybe three, if that's it. You know, like a day interior, a day exterior, and maybe a night exterior. Which maybe there's some slightly different contrast ratios or something, but don't overcomplicate the work that you're doing with having too many lookup tables, because ordinarily you don't have a DIT. Like Hunt for the Wilder People, Taika had a 9-inch clamshell, like handheld monitor, and I lit the whole film off a 7-inch monitor on the camera. So, you know, like there's a lot of detail that you don't necessarily see. So you're using your eyes a lot of the time to look at the scene, because you're not sitting at a 40-inch monitor like you are on Stranger Things and everything's in 4K. So it's that kind of adapt or die thing. So change it with lighting rather than lookup tables, because then you've got like a base level that you can always go back to in coloring, and it's standardized to a point where you're not, you know, it's not like one LUT is slightly overexposed and one's underexposed, and then you've got to balance all that out. What else is there? Don't bring too much gear. And normally it's like financially restrictive anyway, so you can't. But the key to independent filmmaking is being fast as well, because you don't have, you know, I think on Water People were doing something between like 4 and 6 pages a day outside with a child actor in inclement weather approaching winter, you know, so we could schedule 12-hour days, but we might have 9.5 hours worth of daylight. Most of it's day exterior. So then you think about how do we do that, you know? So you'd have to, sometimes we'd have to light close-ups and wait for the sun to come out in order to do the wide shot, you know, and hope that it would match. So there's things like that that we had to kind of be smart about. And again, that's like, if you feel like you can pull something like that off, but you get the wide shot at the perfect time of day that you want, then maybe that's something that you can, you know, entertain. It's a possibility between scheduling. That's like about trying to think laterally when it comes to reading a 3-page scene that's written at dusk, you know, which writers love to do all the time. And then they just hand it over to you and go, there you go. You need to do all that in one day and try and make it all look consistent. You know, sometimes you have the luxury of being able to split that scene over 3 or 4 days, but actors tend to not like that. Sometimes directors don't. Anyway, but scheduling, I guess, is the biggest thing.
Yeah. I mean, those are all really valuable things that we can scale down even to student projects, just in, mm-hmm. as far as keeping in mind the scheduling and being nimble and fast on your feet. I mean, they're all, yeah, I feel like that's scalable. Very good advice. So what does your research process look like when you're crafting the visuals for a period project like Stranger Things or Minari? Because I know obviously as a production designer, that's something that you'd have to do a lot of research for. Do you look at, you know, things from the period? Does anything change when you're shooting something that's period? Is that even like, I'd love to hear about your process.
I mean, Stranger Things has a real look to it, and there is a real kind of nostalgia about it in the sense that a lot of the techniques from shooting films in the mid-80s that are probably not in fashion so much anymore is part of the look of the show, if that makes sense. Like strong moonlight coming through windows, which is not real in any way, but is a style of the time of those period shows, if that makes sense. So that's probably one example of us kind of bending the rules of what looks real in the interest of an aesthetic for a show. You know, like John Carpenter movies or Spielberg movies where you'd have screaming moonlight, you know, like 2 stops overexposed from a table lamp inside, which is no way realistic. But, you know, that's going back to the days of shooting on 50 ASA film and, you know, having to light projects up so much because you didn't have the latitude or the ASA that we have now shooting digitally. So that's something that's fun that is really specific to Stranger Things. So if you take something like Minari, I wanted it to feel as honest as possible photographically. So I really wanted the period nature of the show to come through almost exclusively in the production design and then just approach it in as much of a naturalistic way as I could. You know, I didn't diffuse any of the light outside because I wanted it to be hot and harsh and sort of overbearing and a little kind of bleached out. And I wanted the trailer to feel a little warmer inside, a little more homely and rely on practicals and all that sort of stuff. But we took a lot of the photographs that ended up in frames in the trailer. So in pre-production, you know, Yeri and Stephen and I and Isaac and Yong, the production designer, would go out, you know, like downstairs at the hotel that we were shooting in Tulsa had a little garden. So we'd put everybody in period clothes, get the kids out there and all of a sudden it was like a day in the park. So we'd shoot those things and then we'd pepper them throughout the trailer. So which was really fun, which I love, like a full immersive location like that. So it doesn't really matter where you look. It feels like it's been considered. Yeah, I do love that. And that's where you can really, if you work closely with a production designer from the get-go and you give yourself a 360-degree location like that, then all it's going to do is free you up to be able to put the camera anywhere and you know that it's legit. Yeah. So that's another argument for getting in on the ground floor with them as well.
Yeah, it's awesome. That's really cute.
It's cool.
So I gotta ask the questions that pertain to the film students that will undoubtedly be starting, you know, from the bottom rungs. What makes someone stand out when they're working in the camera department?
Makes somebody stand out working in the camera department. Work ethic, being on time, don't be late. Sounds simple enough, but there's no excuses. There's an old adage I remember having from when I was a kid, which was like, if you're not 15 minutes early, you're late. So that's something to live by. Don't turn up and say, I'm loading on this job, but I'm really a cinematographer. Like from day one, just don't say that. But be nice, be courteous, listen to everybody, ask questions at appropriate times, be interested, and do stuff yourself. When I first started, I dropped out of university and then was rejected by film school and thought, well, maybe I'll just try and have to be a camera assistant and work my way up through the ranks, which is what I did. And so when I was a loader, I'd work on film jobs and then I'd get short ends from those projects and then I'd borrow a camera from Panavision and then I'd shoot little music videos, or I did a couple of little docos or shitty commercials and that sort of stuff. And taught myself exposure. I'd just go out with some friends and make some short films and stuff. And so I did quite a lot of stuff on my own so that I could make those mistakes and learn from those on jobs where it didn't really matter. Because it's a tricky thing. Like if you want to shoot, it's a real kind of catch 22 situation, because you need the work to get the reel, but you need the reel to get the work. You know, so you can't just go, I promise you I'm a cinematographer, employ me and I'll show you. You have to have something to show people in the first place. So that's where it really pays off to do some stuff yourself. And being in a film school environment like you guys are, you're surrounded by like-minded, enthusiastic, smart people who will be as interested as you are. So if you help each other out on each other's projects, changing different roles, which I'm sure you probably do anyway, that's a really good way to have something tangible at the end of the day to show people and for everybody to get a little taste at what everybody's roles are.
For sure. So now I'm actually going to open it up to a few of my friends who have been patiently waiting.
Sure.
Thank you so much for coming. I was wondering if there are any, like, since you work with multiple directors, what do you find works best as a direction for you from the director? Like what are helpful, non-helpful cues a director can give?
Sure. It's a good question. I will be as creatively involved with the director as they're prepared to let me, if that makes sense. So I always like to have a conversation. I had a conversation with the director the other day because I'm going to go and do another A24 film in a month or two. And I was asking him about his process and how you like to work. And I literally said that because, like I said before, it's like a good idea is a good idea. And I in no way want to be the director of a project. I just want to try and be enabled in a way that I can contribute to the best of my ability to make that project as good as I can on a holistic level. You know, so if that means that they're cool with me whispering in the ear and saying, what about if we did a little performance tone like such and such? And it's not like, if you do that in a discreet way that they know that you're not trying to steal their job, and it's strictly in the interest of doing the best version of that film that you can, and they're okay with that. It's the same as them with me in lighting or framing or when to move the camera. It's like I'm very open-minded to that being as reciprocal as possible. So I guess for me personally, I don't like anybody just saying this is how it's going to be and it's non-negotiable, and I don't work like that, and I don't like working with people that are like that as well. I think that it has to be a fluid two-way, three-way, four-way conversation where everybody feels like they can contribute. So I guess as far as relationships with directors go, those are the ones that I like the most. I don't like a dictatorship. I like it to be more of a democracy, I guess.
I did a little bit of research and I heard you talk about how you find it beneficial as a cinematographer to choose a style based on a script and not so much like bringing a cinematography style to a script.
Yep.
Can you give me an example of something you have found or even something you look for in a script to start developing a visual aesthetic?
I do think that that's right. And I know that there are some cinematographers who have looks that I like. And when you employ that person, you get that look regardless of what the project is. And that does work for a lot of people. But for me, the way that I like to work is I just find it so interesting and it's an opportunity to try something different. That's what I love about being varied and not necessarily walking into a situation with a predetermined concept of what it should look like. I think a lot of that comes out of the conversations with the director, the tones of the scripts. I guess something like I'd never used color the way that I'd use color in the end of season 3 of Stranger Things, particularly for the mall, like just that super dialed up, saturated blues and pinks and oranges and yellows and stuff, which is really fun. Looked like was kind of taking me out of a zone that I hadn't really done before, and it was really heightened. And that was an opportunity to try something different, I think, for that. And particularly within the narrative that was like 1985, its peak, you know, like dialed up Benetton period, everybody's neon everything. So that was something that we really leaned into on the script, I guess. But another really interesting thing to ask when you're working with directors is score, is music, because a lot of the time that can influence how you move the camera, how wide or tight you might be. And I'm always fascinated with editorial pacing. I like single camera shoots and I like to really dictate the tones visually of how you shoot things, particularly if you get music involved in that, because music is kind of telling you how to feel when you're watching a movie, if that makes sense. And that can really influence lighting as well. So there's a lot of start, a lot of preliminary questions you can ask directors, because if they give me examples of music or paintings or pictures or whatever, or just at like an overall tone of a film, then you can start to put all those things together and that and mix it up. And then that can really influence, that should really tell you how you should photograph that movie, if that makes sense, or that TV show or whatever it is.
Hi, my question is kind of related. I'm curious about how you approach deciding on whether you're gonna do a scene or like a long take or something in a more stylistic approach or sort of cleaner. How do you look at the script and decide what should go where and where that needs to happen versus where it should
go? When you're breaking down a scene, I always like to ask myself internally, whose scene is it? Because a lot of the time it tends to be favored towards one particular actor. It's one, it's more important to one person than another at that point of the film. And then sometimes that can determine how you want to cover it. Well, I think it should anyway, rather than just doing coverage for the sake of coverage, because there's an opportunity to kind of put an exclamation point on a tonal moment in a film with it's sometimes it's as important as what you don't shoot as what you do shoot, if that makes sense. And sometimes if you shoot things and give people the options, you can kind of overcomplicate it in a sense that it doesn't necessarily need to be as involved as that. I like to, if you don't shoot it, you can't use it. And I know that sounds simple, but I think that that's something to think about as well. I'll use Minari as an example. I mean, something like Minari and Stranger Things are so completely different because Stranger Things is much more high pace and it relies on editorial a lot to create the energy. And also you're working with a lot of kids who have a lot of limitations on their hours. And so you might shoot a close up of Millie and then she has to go to school. So then you turn around and do her over the shoulder and it's a body double because she can't be there. You know, so there's all that stuff that you have to think about. But something like Minari, Isaac and I were really clear that we wanted it to be as wide as possible. And we would cover scenes in the least amount of coverage that we needed. So, which I love. So we were really trying to control the editorial pace of that project because there's lots of moments where there's not necessarily wall-to-wall dialogue and the dialogue isn't always expositional. So it's nice to not have to cut away and just have pregnant pauses and silences in frames, you know, rather than tightening all that up, which is a temptation with editorial. So hopefully that answers the question, but sometimes it's what you don't shoot that can really help, because if you have nothing else to cut to and you all agree that we want to stay on this shot for that period because we want to see these two people standing in a room not talking to each other, then you're stuck with it, which I don't know. I like that. I find that interesting.
Hello. I just want to preface with a big thank you about Minari. I was really, really happy with just your deliberate like looking and approach, and just it was so relatable that way. I just wanted to say a huge thank you.
Oh, that's very sweet. You're welcome. What's your background? Are you Korean?
I'm Korean. So I watched it with my parents last night and it was just a lot of crying.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's lovely.
But I wanted to ask a bit more nerdy question about Stranger Things. I know for Stranger Things for Netflix, it had to be an HDR production for like the Dolby Vision aspect. Was there some challenges as a DOP, and did you prefer to shoot like film or with the HDR kind of aspect?
When we shot season three, we shot on the red VistaVision cameras, the large format 8K cameras, and we framed for 7K because we always have a little bit of look around room if we need to pan and scan or blow things up or stabilize or something like that. As far as the HDR goes, I always try and light in a way where there's always information on the negative, quote unquote, you know, like it's nothing's not completely black or completely white, so that you have that range in there anyway. But I know that there was HDR work that was done more as a post-production thing at the very end. But as long as you're careful about maintaining your exposure ratios and not blowing things out or underexposing things too much, then cameras are pretty good these days. You've got, you know, 13, 14 stops worth of latitude to be able to play with. You've kind of got like 7 up and down either way, which is quite a lot. In many ways, it's more than a lot of film that I used to, like slower ASA film that I used to shoot on. So if you're careful, then you should be all right. And sometimes you can make sort of like overly aggressive lookup tables that might, you know, blow the whites out and pull the blacks down more than they will record on the raw, so that you've got a little bit of an extra buffer there as well. So if you just use that as your latitude, then you know that you've got maybe another stop or so up your sleeve above that. So yeah, little tricks like that you can do to help yourself out. But no, there's a mystery of when you shoot film that you know, the cinematographer only really knows what it is exactly that's happening that is peeled away whenever you shoot digital, because you plug it in with a lookup table onto a 4K monitor and that's exactly what it's going to look like, which is kind of good and bad. I mean, I do miss the film days a little bit, but I also don't miss the sleepless nights when I push things a little too far and I'm the only one that really knew that. And then I'm waking up in the morning and hope that everything's okay.
I was curious about TV specifically, because it's kind of different from movies, especially with Stranger Things. I know that sometimes with Netflix, you start shooting the next season before the previous one has even finished coming out. And I was curious if that's ever, like, changes have come in while you're already in the midst of either preparing or actually making, like, the next season, and whether that those changes, like reactionary changes from the season that's coming out, ever, like, come through your department, and what that's like.
Because there's so much content in Stranger Things, we haven't started. So when we were shooting season three, they hadn't started writing season four, but because they hadn't finished writing season three. So I shot 3, 4, 7, and 8 of season three. And when I was shooting 3 and 4, I didn't have the scripts for 7 and 8 because they hadn't been written yet. But to your point, absolutely. There is stuff that comes up, and we'd have to reshoot little things because there'd be story beats that we had to pick up to establish in an episode that we'd already shot that had just been, you know, anyway. So that did happen a little bit. Or like we'd have to make changes on sets because they hadn't been designed in a way. Like the perfect example is the mall. We didn't know exactly what was going to happen in the mall at the end. We had an idea that something was going to go down, but we didn't know what exactly. So then when it came out that there was the monster, and then I was like, so everything's going to have to flicker, right? Because the monster's there. And we all looked at each other and went, well, yeah, I guess so. So that's when we started testing and redesigning all the neons, et cetera. So that was like that was the biggest example of us having to adapt to script developments whilst shooting, I suppose. But at 100% happens. And even season four this year, same sort of thing, stuff would happen. But also it's like, I don't think I've ever done a project where the script isn't being worked on while you're shooting. It just happens. Like Tyker and I did another film in end of 2019 that isn't out yet. And we would get script notes the night before. And that's kind of how he works. Like it's constantly changing. And you'd get new pages in the morning because he'd rewrite some stuff at nighttime. And most of the time it'd just be dialogue stuff, but sometimes there'd be location specific things and it's just, you just work it out and that's fine. But it's always in the interest of making the project better. And sometimes it's like, it's always evolving. You know, there's three films you make, right? It's the one you write, the one you shoot, and the one that you edit. And it's always, always, always changing. And then you go back and do pickups because one scene works better than it should have or doesn't work as well as, you know. So you have to be flexible. You have to adapt as a cinematographer, because you're like the focal point of facilitating those changes. You know, directors might come up with stuff and they don't necessarily think about the logistics or the execution side of it, or creatively what's the best way to get that from the page to the screen. So that's your job as well.
I kind of want to ask about how storyboarding works on bigger projects, because on student films, mm-hmm. usually the director and the writer storyboards and kind of walks that through. But I assume on bigger projects, I know there's storyboarders and people who are like, that's their job. And I was wondering how that process is working on the bigger production.
Yeah, that's true. That does happen. I like shot lists. I like going through scenes with directors and working out a shot list. I prefer that to a storyboard. Where storyboards are really great is action sequences or stunts or heavy VFX things. They're really helpful for that. Or even animatics. I mean, like when we did the car chase in Hunt for the Wilder People, me and the second unit DP just got a bunch of toy cars and I got my 5D and we literally shot on 5D. And I haven't seen it for years, but it was like a, you know, like you could see hands pushing the police car and then the helicopter would come in. And I made a little like 2 minute animatic of that, so that when you had 30 drivers and 7 helicopter pilots, you could stand around and show them this and say, this is roughly what we're trying to do, because obviously there's safety concerns and it's much easier to show people en masse something like that than it is to describe it, because, you know, it's up for interpretation a little bit more when it's just a shot list. What I don't like about having a storyboard artist is I personally don't like being handed a bunch of storyboards on the day and saying, here you go off and make this, because I feel like if I'm out of the loop by that point, but everybody's wedded to it at that point, because you might have a more efficient way, or you might have you know, everybody's got an opinion to put in for that stuff. And maybe you don't need 20 shots, you could do it in 12, and by combining two or three of these different things, and you could save a little bit of time, but be a bit more creative as to how you put those shots together and combine the actions between multiple frames. But sometimes it's too late because VFX have signed off on it. And that, and I guess it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's really handy and it's great, but sometimes I wish that I would have been involved a little earlier, if that makes sense.
I actually have one more question, actually going off of the VFX, because you have worked on both Stranger Things and Love and Monsters, which mm-hmm. both feature monsters, you know, and lots of VFX. Mm-hmm. How does that relationship work with the head of the VFX? Mm-hmm. And what are you, like, is there a lot of shots where you're framing in nothing? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. kind of walk me through that.
Sure. No, that's a good point. And it is really important to know what the monster's doing, or what, how big it's going to be. How big it's going to be is the key thing. Like, the monster in Stranger Things was a pool skimmer with a beach ball on the end of it. Pretty high-tech stuff. And it was literally just somebody down at the end moving it from one side of the frame to the other, and the first AD tutor on the god mic calling through the action so that, you know, the kids up the top could cower when it was coming towards them, and I could do a lighting cue as some fireworks were going off or something like that. But it is incredibly invaluable to have a reference in there at some point. So we would shoot a version of that with it in there, and then we would take it out and mimic the same camera moves, if that makes sense, so that then you wouldn't have to get into difficult things with trying to paint things out. You could just throw the monster over the top of it. But sometimes, you know, the leg would go too far and then it would expose the ball, and so you do a clean pass of that. It's a really important relationship as well, too, when you're doing a VFX heavy film, to work really closely with the supervisor for exactly that, to make sure that they've got enough headroom for things. You know, like, this monster's not the same height as a person. It's 8 feet or 9 feet or 10 feet or whatever it is. So sometimes it's a pool skimmer with a beach ball. Sometimes it's a person in a green suit on stilts. Yeah, a whole bunch of different things. So that's really important from a framing side of things, because you don't want them to have to actually compromise the size of it, or to realize that, you know, you're cutting the head off here because you haven't framed it high enough, etc.
Yeah, that's valuable. Mm. And that's hilarious. That's awesome.
And shadows as well, too. You think about these things. If you're outside during the day, how do you cast a shadow of this? There's this one scene in, I don't know if anybody saw it, but there's a scene with Dylan in Love and Monsters where the crab at the end, he drops down and he's got it like a spear or something like that. And the crab skewers itself on that, but then goes over the top of him. And it's like, and it was, we're shooting in the middle of the day, so we're talking about how he would always have a shadow over him at that point. So we built this big 20-foot rotating negative so that at that point we could, you know, articulate it off a crane so that there would be the shadow over the top of that. It was obviously square, but the VFX guys could paint the shadow of the crab over the top of that. So there was some interactivity of all that. So that's stuff that you can't really fudge in VFX, to go from like a full frontal hard sun to an overcast look with no shadows in there. It's very hard to do that artificially. So that's another thing to think about, is the lighting interaction of monsters in situations like that as well.
Wow, that is also something I absolutely never would have thought of, but is good to know. So now I'm actually going to, I think I asked you to prepare 5 film recommendations. So I'm going to get you to share those now and talk about why you chose those.
Hard thing to do, to condense movies into 5. But so the ones I chose were Badlands, Terrence Malick, 1973. Lahaine, I don't know if you've seen that, Matthew Cassavetes' film. That's a really interesting execution of what's essentially 3 people talking a lot. Just the way that they use the camera for that film, just the different techniques. It's an incredibly smart film. Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker, I don't know if you've seen that. In the Mood for Love, because who doesn't love Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle? And Koyaanisqatsi Scotsy, because there's an example of a film where there's no dialogue. It's music and the camera telling the story. So you're not relying on exposition, you're relying on tone and mood. And editorially, it's really interesting. The music's wonderful. It's just a very different style of filmmaking. So there you go.
Thank you. I haven't seen that one, but I will have to check it out. But yeah, In the Mood for Love is a very popular choice. It's just a phenomenal film. Oh, yeah.
There's nothing to not like about that movie.
It's pretty much perfect. There's not, there's not a thing I would change about it. But I think that is it. So thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your journey, Lachlan. And thanks to those of you who asked questions. But that is all for this episode of Film Kid Asks. Be sure to watch Love and Monsters, now streaming on Netflix. And be sure to subscribe and follow us on Instagram or join our Facebook group for information about upcoming guests. New episodes come out every Saturday.